come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
We was getting too big for our bitches.
Excellent day for an exorcism.
What have you done to its eyes?
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Biddy well, little brother. Biddy well.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to episode 160 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. And in this episode here is going to be my last Italian Horror Month episode for this year, as this is going to be overall number 16, but fourth episode of season 4 here. And on this one, I have featured reviews. I did actually go get to see The Menu, so that'll be one of them. And then I have it paired up with Dante's Inferno from 1911. Not the greatest double feature here, but there are some interesting stuff, especially with the mini reviews that I'll be getting into as well, which are The Witch's Curse. I did a rewatch of You Are Not My Mother, and then I also got to watch Violent Shit too. Now, if you are listening and notice that my voice is, you know, different from here to some other spots as well, I did record some of this ahead of Saturday, which was a football game between two rivals, and I mean the American football game. But not really going to get into that. It's kind of a sore subject at the moment. And you also might hear my cat, Cammy, on the mini-review section as she was pretty incessant to get fed this morning, and it wasn't time yet. So I think that's all I need to get you up to speed with here. So what I will say then is thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
And for my first mini-review here is going to be The Witch's Curse from 1962. This goes by the original title, Machiste alla Inferno. This was directed by Ricardo Freida. This was written by Ernesto Bonacoli and Piero Pirati. And then the story was written by Eddie H. Given. This stars Kirk Morris, Helena Chanel, and Vera Salenti. This is an adventure fantasy horror film that is from Italy. It is currently sitting on a 5.1 on IMDb and a 2.9 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being Machiste travels to hell to find a witch and make her undo a curse she put on the surface world. So this is a movie that I discovered when looking for horror from 1962. There were also from being Italy. Now, I'm doing this as part of Italian Horror Month. Now, seeing the title, I was intrigued about what we were going to get here. I came into this one blind, other than the information I've just given here. So, what is interesting is watching this the same week that I watched Dante's Inferno, as this borrows from the source material and the imagery. This doesn't go as in-depth, but how hell looks here is similar. I did find this interesting, as I also realized that early on, this falls into the sword and sandal or sword and sorcery films from Italy. When Machiste shows up and he is portrayed by Morris, I was confused. He was supposed to be in Scotland, but we have this guy in a loincloth. Doing a bit of digging, this falls into those films that I was saying that had adventures in different places. Almost like Hercules, Goliath, and Samson, you know, being from this country and everything. And it's all kind of interchangeable. So that out of the way, I also found this interesting is that this starts off like Black Sunday or City of the Dead, with a witch being burned at the stake and cursing those that are doing it. to go farther than that, this feels like the Salem witch trials as well, as we have a judge who is accusing someone as a personal vendetta. There isn't money involved, but he loved her when she was younger, and then she shunned him. I'm not fully sure if she was a witch or not ahead of her execution, but she is now in the afterlife. I don't blame her. I'd be angry too. Where I want to shift would be back in hell. I was talking to my wife about this movie, and she pointed out that Italians tend to be Roman Catholic, which I definitely agree there. That makes sense to have Machiste go to hell here to save Martha. Now, that character is portrayed by Salenti. What is interesting is that we also have figures from, you know, Greek and Roman mythology trapped there, like Prometheus, portrayed by Remo Del Angelis. He is having his entrails ate constantly by a hawk, and that's when I realized that's who that is. Now, Goliath also shows up as a villain here, and in this he's portrayed by Pietro Ciccarelli. This is a character that has his own line of movies, so I kind of found it interesting here to have him as a villain that takes on Machiste. This one is just using the name for a giant. There is different elements combined here than putting them in Scotland. I'm assuming that due to the witchcraft aspect, as this also kind of feels like the Mayfair witches that you would get from Anne Rice. Now, that came much after this, but I'm wondering if she kind of based some stuff in Scotland mythology, or Scottish mythology, I guess. It feels out of place, but I don't hate it for this movie here. Something I wanted to slide in is that this isn't a sequel to the Machiste Adventures according to IMDb. This does, however, reference them. He must remember his past to break his spell, so we see flashes of him fighting a Cyclops and even going to China to help stop the Mongolian invasion. Thought that was funny and just wild that the adventures they send this hero on. I'm not sure if the time periods necessarily match up for what they have here and in China. I will admit that I didn't confirm. What helps here is that we don't know what year the things are happening in this. We just know 100 years have passed from when the witch was executed to the events of this movie. And I think now I'll move over to the acting. I thought that Morris has a good build to be this muscle-bound character. He also seems to be like a good guy, so I believe he would go on missions to help people. The best performance, though, is probably Chanel. Now, she is given the most to work with the villainous witch, who also is the name of Martha. But she also gets the role of Fauna, so she gets to do a bit more. Salenti is fine as the catalyst for Machiste to help. Now we also get Andrea Bosic as Judge Paris. I thought he was good as this evil guy there. Other than that, I would say that Angelo Zaloni as Charlie Law and the rest of the cast are fine for what was needed. So the last thing is going to be the filmmaking. I like seeing this underworld version of hell. It is similar, as they said, to what I saw with like Dante's Inferno, which is fine. We don't get a lot in the way of effects, but what we do are practical. There was nothing there that took me out of the movie, so that's all I ask for. And I would say the soundtrack was fine to build the atmosphere as well. So in conclusion, this is a fun sword and sandal adventure that has horror elements. We get a witch, a curse, journeying into hell, and even a bit of mythology mixed in. I think that Morris is good as our lead, but the best performance is Chanel. The acting, aside from that, was solid. I thought that this was well made. There were no issues there. This is just a movie that knows what it's doing, and I had fun with it. This is more of a 1960s popcorn flick that you can just kind of shut your brain off and enjoy. So my rating here for The Witch's Curse is going to be a 6.5 out of 10. And then for my second mini review, it's going to be quite brief because I've already actually covered this one, and I'll get into that here in a second, but it's You Are Not My Mother. This is technically from 2021, but getting its wide release here this year. This was written and directed by Kate Dolan. This stars Hazel Dupuis, Paul Reed, and Carolyn Bracken. This is a drama horror film that is from Ireland. It is currently sitting on a 5.9 on IMDb and a 3.2 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, in a North Dublin housing estate, Char's mother goes missing. When she returns, Char is determined to uncover the truth of her disappearance and unearth the dark secrets of her family. So for this one here, it was a featured review on episode 126, which was Trek to the Twos number 1, as I had this paired up with Freaks from 1932. So this is a movie that I thought was solid. We get an interesting character study of Char, who is portrayed by Dupuis, where home life and how she is treated is difficult. It is also incorporating potentially a creature as well. It is one that I've seen more of in recent years, but I don't mind how it's handled when it's done properly, which we get here. They do well with allowing us as a viewer to determine what we are seeing. The acting was good. The effects were solid. I thought this was shot well, as it helps to hide things there. And it's also some beautiful framing as well. The soundtrack and design did help to build the atmosphere. I thought this was above average with my first viewing, and I've come up with a second one, and I now think this is good. It's also a contender for my year-end top 10 list. Not really sure where it's going to fall as of yet, so I got some more rewatches to do, but I did want to say that. So I would recommend giving this one a viewing for sure. So my rating now for You Are Not My Mother is an 8 out of 10, and I will say I will direct you to episode 126 if you want to hear more. And for my final mini review of this week is going to be Violent Shit 2. This is from 1992. This is written and directed by Andreas Shinas. This stars Anki Prothman, Shinas as well, as and then Claudia von Biel. This is a horror film that is from Germany. It is currently sitting on a 3.7 on IMDb and a 2.4 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being: drilled by his deranged mother, Carl the Butcher Jr. takes revenge for the gruesome death of his father. Anyone who sets foot on the forest has to die. So this is a movie that I bought blindly due to it being in a box set. I've heard about this one being one of the more notorious shot-on-video films, so I was intrigued to check it out. And I respect enough of what the original one did, but it isn't necessarily what I'm into. Regardless, I own this, so I wanted to check it out. So, where I want to start, though, would be that I'm going to give credit for keeping continuity and developing a bit more story. There's not a lot, though. I did want to set that up. That's not to say that there aren't plot holes, but the story is almost non-existent, so it's kind of a weird thing going on there. So I do want to delve a bit more into the backstory that they're trying to establish. I thought it was interesting that this referenced the real-life serial killer of Fritz Hanke. What is intriguing there is that I wasn't sure if this movie was trying to say that Carl is this guy or that they were just similar. Because, I mean, they're talking about how they were cellmates at this mental hospital. From there, it feels like they're borrowing from Mother's Day from 1980, the trauma film. The mother in this is as depraved, just like her son, and encourages him to kill like his father did. I did like this. There's an odd incest that is going along with this to keep her son, you know, satisfied as well. Now, before getting away from this, I did want to bring in a plot hole of the fact that Carl seen your father and a child. I don't fully remember the ending of the original movie, but I thought that he survived. It is fully possible that he could have fathered a child with this woman who was insane. The problem is that when does this take place then? Carl was locked up as a boy. Carl Jr. is a full-grown man. That would mean that this movie would take place in the future. The earliest it could be would be 16 years after the original one. I have seen kids who are physically large for their age. Puberty would be needed there, so I'm giving that a rough age. It doesn't fully match up. So this movie isn't watched for the story. It's watched for the effects. I will give credit here. For the budget they're working with, we get good stuff. I think the blood looks good and looks real enough. There are violent deaths which live up to the name of this. There were ones that made me even cringe. Now, Jamie did come down while I was watching this late or into it and questioned me. She thankfully didn't see the worst stuff. These aren't perfect, but I was still impressed. So let me take this over to the filmmaking and acting. I'd say this is shot well enough. It looks fine for an SOV. I'd even say that the editing here is solid. Soundtrack was fine. I did have a soft spot for the theme song that uses the name of the movie in the series. That made me smile. According to the IMDb page, there were 3 cast members listed. Prothman was good as the mother. I like Shinas as Carl the Butcher Jr., mostly for his size. He does play the character a bit dumb, but that did actually fit. Other than that, I thought the rest of the cast was fine. They were mostly victims with very little development. It is what it is, and they worked in that respect. So in conclusion, this was like the first one that I'm not the target audience. There is a simple story. I would have liked a bit more and, you know, some foundation for it. There is more to showcase with the gore, though, and I think that looked good. The acting fit well enough for what was needed. I'd even say this is competently made. If you like gore, give us a watch, as this is a German splatter flick, so keep that in mind coming in. So my rating here for Violent Shit 2 is going to be a 4 out of 10. Let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer then for my first featured review.
Good evening. Welcome to Hawthorne. It'll be our pleasure to feed you.
Tonight will be magical.
Over the next few hours, you will ingest fat, salt, protein, and at times entire ecosystems.
We're eating the ocean. We're eating the ocean.
Are you crying?
It's just I find it all very moving.
So it's okay, but I'm not as into this as you are. Oh my God.
You shouldn't be here tonight. You, my dear guests, are not the common man. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir!
Is he gonna keep doing that?
What happens inside this room is meaningless compared to what happens outside.
Yes, sir!
We're but a frightened nanosecond.
Yes, sir!
Nature is timeless.
Yes, sir!
What the hell is going on?
Yes,
I love you all.
Yes, sir! We love you too, sir!
Any questions?
Is this bergamot I'm getting, Chef?
Yes, it is.
And for my first featured review on this episode is going to be The Menu. This is from here in 2022, directed by Mark Myloid, written between Seth Rice and Will Tracy. The stars Ralph Fiennes, Anya Taylor-Joy, and Nicholas Hoult, while also featuring Hong Chow, Janet McTeer, Paul Adelstein, John Leguizamo, Amy Carrero, Reed Bierney, Judith Light, Rebecca Kuhn, Rob Yang, Arturo Castro, Mark St. Cyr, Peter Grost, Christina Brucato, Adam Alderkiss, and John Paul Allen. This is a comedy horror thriller film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 7.6 on IMDb and a 3.8 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being: a young couple travels to a remote island to eat at an exclusive restaurant where the chef has prepared a lavish meal with shocking surprises. So this is one that, I'll be honest, when I saw it was coming out, I didn't know it was horror until doing my weekly check of what was coming to the theater. I did hear someone via social media say they liked this one, so I checked my schedule to see if it could fit in, and thankfully, as you can tell, it worked out for me. And so before I get into the movie itself, let me do some featured notes, as I'll start with our director of Myloid, who has 8 works that he's helmed. Looks like he's mostly done comedy from what I saw, and this is his first step into horror. Then to our writers, first is Rice, who has, you know, that's their feature film debut. Their co-writer of Tracy has 2. This is the only one in horror, though. Moving to our cast, I'll start with Fiennes. He has 96 total movies. I've seen him in things like the Harry Potter movies and Schindler's List. Also, I've seen him in Spectre, and now that I'm thinking about it, he was also in Red Dragon. Now, I've seen 14 of his total works. I've only seen 2 in genre, though. The other one is Cormormont from 1993 that I have not heard or seen, and that is heard of. Shifting to Taylor-Joy, she has 30 features. I've seen 9. Out of horror, I've seen her in The Northman. I've also covered her before with The Last Night in Soho. I've seen 6 of her 7 in genre, but the only one that I haven't is Morgan from 2016. Lastly will be Hout, who has 43 works, and I've seen 10. Out of genre, I've seen him in Mad Max Fury Road, Deadpool 2, and the X-Men movies. In genre, he has 2 that are out, which is this and Warm Bodies. Now, he's slated to be in Robert Eggers' Nosferatu, as well as next year's Renfield, which is kind of interesting. Nosferatu originally was based on the same novel of Bram Stoker's Dracula. So we'll start this off here. The movie itself taking our guests to an island, so they're at a dock waiting for the boat. We have Tyler, who is portrayed by Hult, who is talking to his girlfriend of Margot, portrayed by Taylor-Joy. He is a foodie and scolds her for smoking, telling her that she'll ruin her palate. He is paying this high price for them to come to this exclusive place. She doesn't seem all that thrilled, but willing to come. Now, they are joined by others. There is a food critic of Lillian, portrayed by McTeer, and she is accompanied by someone from the magazine that she works for, by the name of Ted, portrayed by Adelstein. They are both pretentious. There is also John Leguizamo playing an older movie star that is trying to get back into the business with his assistant, Felicity, portrayed by Carrero. There is Richard, portrayed by Bierney, and his wife of Anne, portrayed by Light. It's interesting, though, is that he seems to know Margot as well as vice versa, and his wife seems to think that she looks familiar. Now, lastly is a group of guys who are entitled of Bryce, portrayed by Yang, Soren, portrayed by Castro, and Dave, portrayed by St. Cyr. Now, this group gets on a boat and heads to the island. They are greeted there by Elsa, portrayed by Chow, who gives them a tour of the island. The next little bit here is an awkward moment, is Tyler puts down a on the list to get in another woman's name who we learn later he broke up with or broke up with him, something like that. They're no longer together before bringing Margot, so she's actually not on the list. They still let her in, though, but I digress. So they all arrive at the restaurant. Dinner service lasts over 4 hours with multiple courses. The chef in charge is Slowick, portrayed by Fiennes. He gives them a night that they will never forget, as things aren't as they seem. The guests get agitated, but they don't interfere with what he has planned. So that's why I'm going to leave my recap, and, you know, without going into spoilers, part of it is that we aren't getting the most complex story here. This movie is quite unique as well. It is taking elements of something like And Then There Were None from Agatha Christie, but it isn't necessarily with us getting them picked off one by one and us not knowing. We do get violence and there is death, but it's more in line with Saw here. While watching it, I was wondering if this restaurant was so exclusive that, you know, none of these people have ever been there or anything like that, but Richard has actually been to this place multiple times. There is something new that Chef Slowick is doing, though. Now, I'm going to go a bit into this a bit more without spoiling, but Tyler points out to Margot early on that Chef Slowick likes to have a theme and a story to his menus. The goal is to try to figure it out by the end of the meal. What is interesting is that one of the first plates they get is just rocks with scallops and vegetation from the island. Tyler is impressed, even though, like most everyone else, including Margot, are not. Another interesting dish is one that is supposed to come with bread, but instead they just get the different spreads that you would put on it. Again, Tyler's amazed by this. Lillian critiques one of the spreads for not being prepared better. Chef Slowick is watching them and taking note. Everyone has a reason that they're there except Margot. This bothers Slowick, which is interesting to where things go. Now, where I want to go next would be the setting. I love that this is on an island. It makes it where our characters are trapped. Not to mention, Slowick has many people that work for him. This makes it even more difficult that they know the island and that there are enough of them to keep everyone in line. It is also interesting to go along with this for the fact that this is a restaurant of fine dining on an island like this. It almost makes it interesting duality to where they are and what they're doing as well. So last bit of story I want to go into would actually take me over to the acting. We have an interesting cast that is good. Taylor Joy is our star, and she is spot on here. What makes this work is that we get an idea of our characters, but as the story progresses, things get revealed. Her portrayal of Margot is good, and I'm just a big fan of her in general. Fiennes is equally there. He is such a presence about him that he's intimidating, which is what we need. There's also the sadness under the surface as well. Holt's performance is also good as this foodie. He's quite pretentious in his love of Slowick. Now, Chow is good along with the rest of the kitchen staff. The other guests are, for the most part, annoying by design, which is also good. There's just not a bad performance here, as we just have a solid cast across the board. So the last thing I'm going to go into before doing some trivia is the cinematography. And actually, I'm actually going to go into the filmmaking first will be cinematography, which is good. We get interesting shots, and it does well in bringing to life how isolated this island is. The restaurant itself is modern, which works as well. We don't get a lot in the way of effects, but when we do, this does go places. That did surprise me as well. Other than that, I think the soundtrack fit for what was needed. I also like the sound design. That adds another element as well. So then just a little bit of trivia that I've found here on the IMDb page is that screenwriter Tracy came up with the idea of this story while visiting Bergen, Norway, when he took a boat to a fancy restaurant on a nearby island and realized they were stuck or trapped on the island until the meal was done. The lavish food layouts were prepared by renowned French chef Dominique Crenn, the only female chef in the United States to obtain 3 Michelin star restaurants. Stars for her restaurants, that is. Altira Crenn in San Francisco. Though most of the cast and crew were often tempted to taste the delicacies between takes, they had to be reminded that the food items were predominantly props and thus inedible. Several of the beach shots were filmed on Driftwood Beach on Jekyll Island in Georgia. Leguizamo based his character on Steven Seagal, as the two co-starred in Executive Decision from 1996. Originally, Emma Stone was attached to play the lead with Alexander Payne directing. In 2021, Taylor Joy replaced Stone and My Lloyd directing. Lillian criticizes the breadless bread plate for containing a broken emulsion. An emulsion is a mixture of immixable, I think it's how you'd say that, substances in cookery. It usually means oil and water, which an emulsifier, a substance that allows them to mix, such as an egg yolk. A broken emulsion is one in which the oil and water have separated again. It is possible that Slowick deliberately served it to Lillian broken, as to hint to the separation between have and have nots that would come later in the evening. A 1-minute trailer was released on May 20th. Fiennes and Holt previously appeared in Clash of the Titans 2010. And Graz the Sommelier was in Stranger Than Fiction with producer Will Ferrell, who also produced this one here. There are 12 dining guests, just like the apostles in the Last Supper. And now there's also kind of an interesting thing here is that Lillian is seen smoking her own cigarettes with Margot. This shows that although indirectly, she is not a proper good critic as her palate would not be clean and thus could not have reviewed other restaurants poorly and unfairly. So kind of another interesting little thing there to kind of hint a bit to what we're getting here. So in conclusion, this is a good movie. I'm glad that I came into this one blind like I did and just let it wash over me. We get an interesting story here that explores social commentary. This is something I didn't bring up until now. It is limited, though, with the overall story, but it's more about our characters and their decisions, as well as things they've done in the past. The performances are good. This is well made. I don't know if this sticks the landing as much as I would have liked. Not enough to ruin this, though. I will say that its use of comedy and horror elements is a good blend. So my rating here for The Menu is going to be a 9 out of 10. Now, I'm not going to do a spoiler section, so let me get you over to the trailer of my second featured review. If I can find one, that is. And for my second featured review here is going to be Dante's Inferno. This went by the original title of El Inferno. This is from the year 1911. This is directed amongst Francisco Bertolini, Adolfo Pandovan, and Giuseppe Di Lagaro. This is written from the poem by Dante Alighieri. This stars Salvatore Papa, Arturo Pirovano, Di Lagaro also is featured in this movie as an actor, as well as Pierre Della Vigne, Augusto Milla, Attilo Mata, and Emilice Beretta. This is a adventure, drama, fantasy, horror film that is from Italy. It is currently sitting on a 7.0 on IMDb and a 3.7 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being loosely adapted from Dante's Divine Comedy and inspired by the illustrations of Gustave Doré. So this is actually an interesting little movie here. I checked it out due to it being the highest rated or might have been the most popular Italian horror film on Letterboxd that I hadn't seen so far. This might mark the oldest film that I've ever reviewed. Other than that, I knew that this was early into cinema, you know, a take on the classic poem from Dante in the Divine Comedy, and this was a title that always struck with me, by the way, because I kind of think it's interesting with what they're talking about here and, you know, the name of it. So I'm going to do a little bit of featured notes here. This is going to go by pretty quick, but I'll start with our directors, and Di Lagaro is first. He's helmed 12 films. This is the only one that I've seen, and that's also in horror. His co-director of Bertolini had two. This is the only one in horror and that I've seen. He did work with a take on the Odyssey with Di Lagaro as well. Now, the same thing for Padovan. As a writer, Dante has 6 adaptations of his work. This is the only one in horror that I've seen. Moving to our cast, I'll start with Papa. This is the only film he was ever in. Same for Piravano. And now D. Lugaro has 3. He was also in The Odyssey that he directed, and this is the only one in horror, as well as the only one that I've seen for all of these people. So, that was what I was saying. Pretty quick. So, this is going to be a fairly short review. This is a silent film that follows Dante, who is portrayed by Papa, as he was, I guess, was having a dream. Dante starts in the woods where he is lost. He heads for a mountain and ascends. His path is blocked by 3 animals. There is a panther that stands for avarice, a lion for pride, and a she-wolf for lust. Now, an angel by the name of Beatrice asks Virgil, portrayed by Piravano, to guide Dante. He directs him to the portal that takes him to hell. Now, from there, they get to see the different circles and those that are kept there. Charon, the ferryman, takes him over the river of Acheron. Now, the first place is limbo of people who were either cast out of heaven or died before Christianity started. There are those that are also unbaptized. Now, the likes of Homer, Horace, Ovid, and Lucernes are kept here as they live without hope prior to Christ. There is also a king who passes judgment. He does allow poets to pass as well. Now, it is from here that they go on their journey to the center circle. It is there that they find the frozen level as well as Lucifer, who in this is portrayed by Mila, who feeds on damned souls as punishment. These are also the ones that committed the most heinous sin according to the Bible. Dante will then need to find his way out before it is all too late. So where I want to start here is that I have never read this work, and I don't know if I've ever actually read anything else from Dante, but he's someone that I know. This would also mark the first time that I've actually watched an adaptation of his work. What I will say is that I thought close to these opening thoughts is that he's someone I do want to read as it intrigues me. I'm an atheist, but reading Christian mythology is something that interests me. That goes for things like Paradise Lost as well. With that out of the way, I can see how this film, as well as the source material, influence other things. Looking back, I've seen Jigoku, which comes from Japan, and that borrows from this. That was someone who is journeying into hell, seeing the different punishments on different levels, and trying to get out with a loved one. This is a fascinated nightmare that Dante had. I'm guessing the book is following him as a character, like we get here, so I like the adaptation has Dante as our lead. Something else that struck me is the movie The House That Jack Built. I didn't realize how much that borrowed from this, as Jack is telling his story to Virgil and has his own journey in hell as well. So what really makes it stand out though are the visuals. This is from 1911, and I give them credit as for what they did. Seeing the different circles of hell as well as the punishments are fun. We get things like a circle where wind blows those around that are damned. There's a swamp where people are punished and people have their heads buried in sand. The Shining one, though, is a giant Lucifer eating someone who has been punished. These are all done with in-camera effects. Do they look great? No, but we're also talking about a movie that, at the time of recording this, is 110 plus years old. I was impressed. The cinematography to go with this is good. I'll also include that the version on YouTube I watched had a live score that fit for what they needed, and it does add good atmosphere as well. So the last things to go into here before I do a bit of trivia would be the acting. What is surprising is that they don't do the typical over-the-top stuff you'd expect for a silent film. I think that Papa does a good job as Dante. He is shocked and in awe of the things that he has seen. Piravano as Virgil is good as his guide. I want to give credit to Mila as Lucifer and the rest of the cast of those that are damned people. It looks quite amazing with their performances in the setting for sure. So as I was saying, there's a bit of trivia here on the IMDb page. Don't know if I'm going to go through it all, but I did find some stuff. Is that this is the first time a film was being shown in its entirety in one screen, like a feature, in the U.S. Prior to this, the audiences wouldn't be prepared to sit for over an hour to watch a feature. Films like Les Mis from 1909 and Life of Moses from 09 were shown in episodic parts over the course of a month or two. Considered to be the first Italian and oldest surviving feature-length film. While credited as a loose rendition of the Divine Comedy poem, the entirety of the motion picture follows every laid-out sequence in its narrative. The men being chewed on upon the 3 heads of the devil in the climax are Brutus, Cassius, and Judas Issarach? I don't know how to say his name. The 3 are considered the history's greatest traitors. In July 1911, the Monopole Film Company claimed to be the first U.S. film distributor to use 24-sheet billboard posters to promote a film. According to People's Almanac Guide to the 20th Century, this is the very first movie to ever be shown male front nudity, well over a half a century before it turned up again in Women in Love in 1969. Arguably the world's first blockbuster, the first feature-length horror film, regarded by many scholars as the finest adaptation of Dante's works to date. The depiction of the Nine Circles visually are done in accordance to Doré's engravings and paintings portraying Dante and Virgil's journey through hell in the Divine Comedy volume Inferno. International success is that actually probably take home about $2 million. The circles of hell are limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, anger, heresy, violence, fraud, treachery. First screen in Naples, Lucifer as he appears in the 10th circle, treachery, and the last obstacle before Dante and Virgil descent and escape from hell is feasting upon three male corpses at once. Despite the most darkened human face, in the devil as he appears bears two sighting demonic faces while chewing mouse in accordance with the depiction of Satan in by Dory. Took 2 years to fully complete for its release. The three-headed hound of hell in the for gluttony is the mythological creature Cerberus. And this also is kind of using things like Hades' guards to the underworld and its inner sanctum of Tartarus. And I think that's all I'm going to actually do here. So in conclusion, this is better than I was expecting. The visuals that bring this to life from the drawings of someone's interpretation of Dante's Divine Comedy is great. It is impressive what they could do with this, you know, how long ago with in-camera tricks. The acting I thought was good for what they needed. Soundtrack going with that helped to build that atmosphere as well. I did see there's another version out with Tangerine Dream score, which I do need to seek this out because that might even make my enjoyment of this much more. If you're into the history of cinema and horror, I'd recommend giving this one a viewing. So my rating for Dante's Inferno is going to be an 8 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section. I don't really think I necessarily need to do that. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show. I would like to welcome you back, and then just to close everything out here, if you'd like to send me an email with any sort of feedback or anything that you'd like to have read on the show, you can send me that email at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. If there's anything that you send me you don't want read on the show, just let me know in that email. If you'd like to read any of the reviews from anything on this episode or any of the past episodes, that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr., on Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. And over there, I'll be posting all of the reviews of anything that I'm watching that is horror or non-horror alike. If you'd like to follow my Instagram page, that's David OSU87. If you'd like to follow the Journey with a Cinephile Instagram, that's Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. What I will be posting over there is on both of them the movie posters of anything that I am reviewing. And if you follow my personal one, every now and then you might see some personal pictures if I ever post any, because I tend to forget while I'm out and about. And just to make it easier on you, I'll have all of those links in the show notes. And then the last thing I'd ask you to do is that whatever podcatching device you're listening to me on, if you could go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss a new episode, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you're able to rate and review just so I can figure out what I'm doing that you like and what I'm doing that you don't like, as well as to get out to more listeners out there as well. And for the next episode, I'm going to be getting into doing my winter year-end type episodes and everything like that as I start to do my even more rewatches for 2022 films and everything like that. But I know that one of the ones that is winter-based is going to be Black Mountainside. I've actually already watched that. Just need to get my thoughts down and get everything recorded there. But I'm also going to be watching The Leech. I got a screener for that, and I know Jamie seemed intrigued, so I think we're going to end up checking that out. Those will be the two featured reviews on next episode, and then I will, you know, be watching more things that I thought might be a contender for the year-end just to kind of see where everything shakes out, as well as get in some more 2022 watches in between there as well. Don't think there's anything else that I need to get you up to speed with here, so what I will say then in closing is that thank you so much for listening, and whatever you do today, I hope you're safe and doing it and have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.